Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. Thank you for coming out on this cold and somewhat snowy yet beautiful February morning. It is great to see you all here. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College, I want to tell you about the next few programs while our introducer settles herself in. Hi, Sally. Next week, we're going to be hearing from Meg O'Connell, who is the executive director of the Allen Foundation, and she's also the chair of the WorkTrain Collaborative. She'll be here along with Dominic Robinson from Northside Up, who's directing the WorkTrain program, which has to do with training low and unskilled people for existing jobs in the community. So it's a model that is actually innovative, surprisingly so, and I know you'll be interested in that. I also wanted to give you a heads up that in March, we're going to start marking the 50th anniversary of Thursday Morning Roundtable. TMR started in March of 1965. First speaker was the mayor. Our first speaker in March is going to be the mayor. That's just a teaser, and so we will kind of be mirroring that first month at least. The first season, actually, of TMR was a two-month season, March and April of 1965. So we're going to be looking at some of the same topics through a different lens, of course. So that should be fun. And then our 50th anniversary celebration will continue into the fall, and you'll hear much more about that later. Right now, it's my pleasure to welcome Sally Santangelo. Sally is the executive director of CNY Fair Housing, and you might remember that she spoke to us a few months ago about their most recent report. Thanks for being here, Sally.
Good morning. I'm glad I made it through the snow. I think I need snow tires. It's a good investment. I had the privilege of presenting to this group back in November on our agency's assessment of fair housing for Syracuse and Onondaga County. I highlighted some of the housing challenges and issues that we face in our community. But I don't think you needed to hear my presentation or work in housing to know that our city faces some serious housing issues. We have old housing in need of repairs, high vacancy rates, absentee property owners, and it's really easy to get overwhelmed by the scale of the problem that we face. Just two years ago, the city of Syracuse had nearly 4,000 properties that were more than 2 years delinquent in their taxes, which accounted for more than 9% of the city's land parcels, a huge portion. And this is when the Greater Syracuse Land Bank was created in 2012 to help return these delinquent properties into productive use. Our two presenters today are helping lead these efforts to deal with the backlog of these tax delinquent properties. And instead of getting overwhelmed by the scale of the problem, which is easy to do, they are working to address the city's housing issues in the only way possible, which is really working one house at a time. Now, I'm sure when they look at the huge list of properties that they're dealing with, it's probably hard to think of it as one house at a time. That is really how you fix housing, and that's how you improve neighborhoods, and that's how you rebuild cities. Through their combined efforts and with other partners in the community, they are rehabilitating housing and demolishing those properties that blight neighborhoods. And at the same time, they're providing opportunities for first-time home buyers and local investors, and people are paying their property taxes, which is a bit of a bonus. Carrie Quaglia is the executive director of Home Headquarters. If anyone doesn't know, is a private nonprofit that's dedicated to promoting responsible and sustainable home ownership in Central New York. Under Carrie's leadership, Home Headquarters has helped tens of thousands of Central New Yorkers with home improvement loans, home ownership and foreclosure counseling, first-time mortgages, and down payment and closing cost assistance. And prior to his work at Home Headquarters, he served as the director of housing for the city of Syracuse. It probably seems like a long time ago now. And had his JD from the SU College of Law. In his free time, Carrie enjoys working on his own home improvement projects.
I do and them. I don't enjoy them.
You don't enjoy them? All right. And also rooting on the New York Jets, which is why I could see you would do home improvement, because you can actually see the improvement when you work on your house. I also found out in the course of preparing to do this introduction that Carrie has a camp up on Lake Ontario. Thank you. which was news to me. And I imagine Carrie hasn't taken a day off in 5 years, so that might also be news to him. So you really should get up there. I'm guessing the sunsets are lovely up there. Caitlin Wright is the founding executive director of the Greater Syracuse Land Bank. And prior to her role at the Land Bank, she served as a planner for the city of Syracuse, where she conducted data and policy analysis related to vacant, abandoned, and tax-delinquent properties. And she led the team which helped develop the Land Bank's business model and the city's revised tax-delinquent property policy. She grew up in California's Central Valley and earned her bachelor's at the University of Washington in Seattle. She has her master's in regional planning from Cornell University and has a professional background in land use planning and historic preservation. Her time at Cornell certainly prepared her for this job in terms of the intellectual and demands, and hopefully prepared her for living in Syracuse, a long ways from California Central Valley, I'm sure, on a day like today. Caitlin owns a home in Eastwood, where she also likes to tackle her own home improvement projects. I hope you enjoy yours somewhat. And she's also a bit of a foodie and loves to prepare wonderful gourmet meals, and which makes me think I need to have her over sometime. And I have a mudroom that I'd like to build, so perhaps we can do that. So obviously, these two share a couple things in common. Their willingness to take on home improvement, their somewhat nerdy love of urban planning, and but I think what's important and what's really a benefit to us in this community is that the two of them both share an ability to see a house that is run down and neglected and to imagine it as a home again, to imagine a family living there and to imagine what the new countertops are going to look like and what a new roof is going to do and what new siding is going to help make that neighborhood better. And I look forward to hearing what they have to say and some of the great work they're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for having us today. That was a great introduction, Sally, and I like what you pointed out about being able to look at a house and see it as potentially being a home. I can't tell you how many times I would go to neighborhood meetings as a city planner, and everybody would be complaining about the vacant house next door. Obviously, it's extremely unpleasant to have a vacant property right next door to you that attracts criminal behavior and nuisance activity, and it depresses your property values, and it kind of depresses your perspective on your neighborhood. You don't want to invest in painting your house if the one next door is falling apart. And everybody would say, tear it down. And I would say, well, what if we got it renovated and had a nice family living next door to you? And you would see this kind of aha moment happen. And I think that's what we want to try to do, is get as many of these houses renovated as possible. We figure that only a small percentage of the ones that are coming into our inventory are demolition candidates. And we're closely tied to the city's tax collection policies as well. So just demolishing our way through this inventory of 1,800 vacant buildings probably wouldn't be a very financially sustainable thing to do either, firstly because demolitions are expensive, and secondly because now we would have an unimproved parcel on the tax rolls. And I'm excited every time we get one of these houses renovated, because it's increasing the value of that property, obviously, but also the properties surrounding it, and hopefully kind of a rising tide will rise all boats. Uh-oh. How do we advance? There you go. Oh, there we go. So I tend to start out with the doom and gloom slide of how we got to this point. As you know, Syracuse has lost a lot of population over the years, and so we have a lot of housing units that are kind of extra buildings that we don't need. And Carrie will talk a little bit about the aging buildings as well and the upgrades that are needed. But what we have now is a concentration of vacant buildings, and that's closely correlated with a concentration of poverty and criminal activity that's attracted to these buildings. And so what we're primarily focused on there's a lot of text here, I apologize, but we're primarily focused on those 1,800 vacant structures and more than 3,500 vacant lots. And the land bank's mission is to get vacant and abandoned properties back into productive use. And we're very closely tied to the city's tax collection efforts, and we're fortunate here in Syracuse that even though the city hadn't very aggressively collected property taxes in quite some time, that presents an opportunity for us. And so we're able to capitalize on that delinquency rate. The city's gotten much more aggressive about collecting taxes. People are coming in droves to pay and avoid foreclosure, which is a very good thing. That means everything's working the way it's supposed to. And those people that are paying their taxes to avoid foreclosure are generating revenue that wasn't coming in before. And that's largely enabling us to go out and acquire the ones that don't pay, that get foreclosed on. That revenue is helping to fund the land bank so that we can do intake evaluations and stabilize these buildings and get them ready to be marketed to get them back into productive use. So the half that pay are supporting the redevelopment of the half that don't. And this is just kind of a picture of what kind of properties are coming into the land bank. The vast majority of what we get are detached wood frame housing, like you'll see on the upper left there. But we do get some larger apartment buildings and some commercial buildings as well. If you look at the spectrum of vacant buildings throughout the city, most of them are housing. And you'll find that those other two categories, mostly the commercial buildings, are far more likely to pay their taxes if they get a foreclosure notice. Land banking, just to give you a little bit of background, is to assemble and hold land for future development or disposal. And part of what we do is assemble and hold for the long term so that we can look at a neighborhood context and all of the abandoned properties in that neighborhood and come up with a holistic strategy for it before we go to market them for sale. So there is a holding period during which time we're engaged in planning, lining up grant funds so that we can work with folks like Home Headquarters to get some of these redeveloped using subsidy. Assembling properties with those that are adjacent to them. So as we get larger pieces of land, they'll be more attractive for development. Another benefit of us having site control, of course, is that we expect our buyers to walk through these houses before they purchase them. So once we own them, they're able to make a much better informed decision about whether they want to invest in that property, and we're able to better evaluate whether they have what it takes to get that house renovated because we know exactly what condition it's in. At the bottom here, it does mention, you know, land banks are quasi-public. Sally mentioned that Home Headquarters is a private nonprofit. We, the Greater Syracuse Land Bank, were created jointly by the city and the county, and we're a public authority. So our meetings are open to the public. Our accounts are open to the public. You can get an awful lot of information off of our website, and we are to be responsive to the public's needs. And so we do look to the public's stated planning goals, the city's comprehensive plan, as we're deciding what to do with these properties. And that's partly because of the type of entity that we are. Our mission, as I stated, is to get vacant and abandoned properties back into productive use. There is some overlap there with the tax delinquent properties. I should probably integrate this into the PowerPoint. You can picture it as a Venn diagram. Of all the tax delinquent properties out there, only a portion are the vacant and abandoned buildings. And of all the vacant and abandoned buildings, only a third are tax delinquent. But that overlap there is the easiest to go after, and that's what we're going after first. We're partnering with the city so that they can use their very cost-effective and quick administrative process of foreclosing for us to get control of as many of those vacant and abandoned properties as possible. And you'll see up here we're talking about some of these have short-term redevelopment potential and some have more long-term redevelopment potential. And we try to balance those two. And fortunately for us, we're able to because of the significant financial support we're getting from the city and the county that's resulting from that new collection process. Many land banks in New York are more focused on short-term redevelopment and not on long-term land banking simply because they were already collecting all the taxes they could. There was not much room to grow and increase revenue collection in the short term. This is just kind of reiterating that point I made earlier about the majority of our initial acquisitions are coming through the tax collection process. You'll see that that's a small portion of the vacant buildings we're able to get that way. The others need to be addressed as well, and we're optimistic that if we can take the vacant buildings that we do acquire, get them into the hands of responsible individuals, get them back on the tax rolls, back into productive use, that's going to have a spin-off effect, and maybe the owner of the vacant building next door now is going to be inspired to make an investment in their property. That will hopefully result in vacant buildings getting back into productive use that the land bank never has to touch and intervene. You know, in an ideal world, We want the private market to do what it's supposed to do. However, we will probably have to get involved in some of the other tax current vacant buildings as well in order to effectuate some neighborhood level change. And we're already acquiring some through donation from banks that have foreclosed on them, private individuals that are donating vacant properties that they just don't have the capacity to handle. And we'll be going out and purchasing some strategic properties as well in the coming year. So I need to give you a little bit of an update. Since I was last here, the land bank has really taken off. We were only recently incorporated in mid-2012. To give you kind of a context for how we got to this point, in November 2012, the city sent out the first batch of foreclosure notices, and that was the time we all decided we're going to get serious about these vacant and abandoned properties and actually take local control. And what we're excited about is by foreclosing on them, we're putting the ultimate fate of these buildings back into the public's control. If we're a quasi-public entity, we can then dictate who's going to be able to buy them. We can screen for more responsible buyers. And it's like taking all these vacant properties that were controlled by absentee landlords, possibly in California. A lot of them are in Brooklyn. And we wouldn't be able to control outcomes. And now outcomes are back in the control of the public sector, which is very exciting for us. You can see here that we've sold our first properties about a year ago. We've sold more than 100 so far, and we've acquired more than 500 to date. Of those 100 that have been sold, many of them we've transferred to our partner home headquarters, who is renovating them with grant funds, and those will become owner-occupied. They'll be marketed as move-in ready properties, fully renovated. But the vast majority of what we sell are being sold to private purchasers. And the overall business model of the land bank was that we're looking at 1,800 vacant buildings in the city. We know the city gets a certain amount of CDBG money every year and a certain amount of federal home dollars, and Cary goes out and applies for other grant funds as well. But there's never going to be enough grant funds to renovate 1,800 vacant buildings. And so our idea was that we would renovate a strategic subset of those in partnership with groups like Home Headquarters that have that expertise already, but that the majority would be sold to responsible private investors who we've diligently vetted to make sure that they know what they're doing, and leverage all that private money to address the scale of the problem. And so far, it seems to be moving in the right direction. We've completed 60 constructions in the past year. We ran a very exciting pilot project to see of all those buildings that can't be salvaged. A lot of material was going to the landfill, and we wanted to see how much of that could we divert from the landfill, and could the act of deconstruction and then also what happens to those materials afterwards create some local jobs. And we were excited to watch that graduates of a CDBG-funded deconstruction training program were hired by the contractor that we hired to do our deconstructions, and they've kept them on to do selective demolition for that company. So it created some jobs in the actual deconstruction itself, and now the materials are being repurposed for new things. And so we're hoping that by keeping some of those materials out of the landfill, they'll fuel more activity in the local economy. So a demolition won't be kind of a total loss. And then we did complete 26 traditional demolitions. It's something that we know how to do pretty efficiently. We've partnered with Home Headquarters to carry those out. They've kind of honed this skill set over the years, and we wanted to utilize that, and we had to doing our pilot project of six was great, but we had to get some numbers done in 2014, and that worked very well. And what you can expect to be coming in 2015, now that we've kind of established capacity to manage a lot of these properties, we expect the city to continue foreclosing and sending them our way. We're gearing up to accept at least 600 of those in the coming year. In the past year, we exceeded our expectations in sales. We're hoping to sell at least 120 properties in this coming year. And we'll be doing a lot more of these renovations in partnership with Home Headquarters. We completed 10 last year, and we're expecting to complete at least 40, 30 of which would be with Home Headquarters and 10 with the county in this current calendar year. We're also going to be rolling out a MOTA-OWN program. Even though we sell our vacant lots to next-door neighbors at a very low price, we do expect them to merge the two parcels together once they acquire, and there's a significant cost to that. Not everybody can afford to do it. But once they take ownership of that property and they're maintaining it, it's kind of eliminating a nuisance in the neighborhood. We want to see that good activity continue. And so for those that can't afford to carry out the resubdivision, if they are going to demonstrate to us that they can maintain the property for a year, keep it mowed, keep the sidewalk shoveled, then we'll find a way to cover those costs. We're also going to be unveiling a competitive grant program in the coming week for community gardens or other green space improvements. I've been approached by a number of folks that have a vacant lot next door. They don't necessarily want to own it, but them and their neighbors would like to get together and use it for recreation. And so we're going to be doing a competition where people coming up with really creative ideas for how to beautify those lots and maintain them over the course of the next year would qualify for some funds to make physical improvements on the site. And we're open, by the way, to other folks' ideas for things like that we can be doing to beautify the properties while we hold them, or to better market them to folks that are going to be able to redevelop them, or certainly to just better utilize them for community benefit. We want to take what's right now an eyesore and turn it into an asset. So if you do have ideas, please feel free to contact us, and all the contact information is right up here. And I'm going to turn it over to Carrie to talk about the much more labor-intensive part of what's going on with the land bank properties, the renovations.
Well, thank you, Caitlin, and thank you, Sally, for those introductory remarks. I'll get even with you later. I try not to admit to anybody that I'm a Jets fan, but thank you for that. Really, home headquarters is all about neighborhood revitalization through home ownership, right? It's pretty common knowledge. If you have a neighborhood that has lots of owner-occupants, it's probably going to be in better shape than a neighborhood that has lots of investor owners. And that's the core of our mission. We fulfill that mission really through three major business lines. The first that we're talking a lot about today is property redevelopment, particularly redevelopment of vacant properties. And over the years, Home Headquarters has taken title to more than 1,000 of these derelict vacant properties. Taken title to hundreds from the city of Syracuse, from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, HUD, and most recently, we are, I think, the land bank's best customer. So we've taken title to about 25 this year, and we'd be looking to do maybe another 40 at least or so land bank properties next year. One difference, though, is as Home Headquarters takes title as a private not-for-profit, we have to pay property taxes. That's one of the reasons why we were so excited to have a land bank, so that the land bank could hold property, these vacant properties that are not in productive use, for a period of time where that meter of the taxes coming due wouldn't be running. But from the second we take title from the land bank or really from anybody else, for sale housing is not a tax-exempt purpose, so we have to pay property taxes. And we're not complaining about that. We think that's a good thing. Over the last 10 years, we've paid about $3 million in property taxes on these vacant and dilapidated properties. But it's not the end of the world. The city of Syracuse has services that they need to provide, and they do need some revenue. So we don't complain about that. But it does mean that we have to be efficient because the clock is running. In addition to property redevelopment, our second business line is community development lending. And really, the best way you can sometimes prevent vacant properties is by giving a particular owner some help in fixing their roof or a furnace or whatnot so that they can stay in the property and doesn't become vacant in the first place. And we do a lot of that. We help about 500 people each year with home improvement loans. As we'll talk in a minute, we've also gotten involved in first mortgages. And then finally, the third business line is our home ownership center. And we tend to think of our home ownership center as preparing folks for the rights and responsibilities of home ownership. We help first-time home buyers. But recently, we've had to do a lot by way of foreclosure intervention. And each year, through those efforts of our foreclosure intervention counselors, we save hundreds of homeowners from going into foreclosure and, again, preventing this list of 1,800 vacant properties from becoming 2,000 or 2,100. So those are our three business lines. The issue of vacant properties can be overwhelming. I think, Sally pointed to the fact that you have to approach it one property at a time. And we certainly agree with that. But when you have a problem of this significance in our community, you can't be throwing darts at a wall. And you need to have a strategy. And we all have to be on the same page, Home Headquarters, the land bank, all of our neighborhood housing partners, and the city of Syracuse, Neighborhood and Business Development. I see Stephanie is back there. And really, I think our marching orders from the city are that we would have two strategies. The first is what we'd call the bad house on the block. And This kind of gives a good example of how that strategy is implemented. So you have the tan here are owner-occupied properties, and you see that one in blue might be a really terrible structure. And we know that if you have a vacant property within eyesight of your house, odds are that your property would be worth about $9,000 less. So this is an example of a property at 224 West Glen. The house on the left, obviously, is the vacant and dilapidated house. The house on the right are...
I can't see that.
Oh, I'm sorry. One more time. There you go. How's that? A neighborhood otherwise full of relatively nice houses, but you have that one bad house on the block. So by renovating that, you're not only improving that home, but you're also making all the other properties on the block more valuable. So you turn that vacant property into something that looks decent. So that's the first strategy, and we do that a lot. Again, neighborhood and business development supports that type of strategy, and we want to do things that are consistent with community planning goals. The second strategy really has to do with making a concentrated effort. If you have, this is a particular block, and it really could be any block where there's an abundance, the shaded blue areas are vacant properties. So you can't really, in good conscience, rehab one of those properties and try to sell it to an owner-occupant and not try to address all the other vacant properties in the neighborhood. And probably the best example that we have of this concentrated effort is the efforts that we've had with the Near West Side Initiative on the Near West Side, where we literally went up and down the streets, Marcellus, Atisco, and purchased hundreds of properties. Some of them were purchased from government, some of them were foreclosed, and many were purchased from private individuals. But that effort was successful because we were able to purchase about 100 of the worst houses in the neighborhood, and infuse that neighborhood with about 60 new homeowners who are now caring for the neighborhood. They have their eyes on the neighborhood. But you can't sell those houses unless you tell them, we're also going to handle the vacant across the street, the vacant next door, that sort of thing. These strategies work, and it's really the only way that we can get up every day and have a sense that we're going to accomplish our mission. It is really done one house at a time, one street at a time, and one neighborhood at a time. Now, irrespective, really, of what type of, and by the way, this is a great example in the Near West Side of three dilapidated properties on a particular street, and then you can turn them into properties that look like that. Now, I'd have to say that effort was really cooking, probably about 6 years ago. And we had lots of tools in the toolbox, right? Remember something called the Syracuse Neighborhood Initiative and the funds that Congressman Walsh was able to bring into town? We also had the Neighborhood Stabilization Program at the time, which has since been defunded. Restore New York. New York had a special pot of funds to do these type of rehab efforts, and that doesn't exist any longer. So we still have to have the same strategies, but we probably don't have as many tools in the toolbox, and that's why you have to be very targeted. But irrespective of the source of funds, whether they're from HUD or the land bank or the city, what we're getting are vacant properties that are really in pretty rough shape. The major systems are shot. You see here a good example of a foundation collapse. The houses might be obsolete in that they have small bedrooms with no closets, or we've been in some where the basement is 4 feet tall, so it's almost impossible to go down in the basement and service a furnace or something along that line. And then also they tend to be full of asbestos and lead and radon. So because of that, demolition has to be part of the equation, demolition and deconstruction. This is an example of a property that was demolished on Midland Ave. As you can see, a major failure of the roof, in addition to very significant structural problems. And next door, you see now, without the house, you hardly notice that it's gone. And it doesn't mean that it's going to be a vacant lot forever. We hope down the road to be able to build some new housing when the market improves or some funding comes into the community, and no problem with that. But we're also doing things that I think are more creative. So this is a property at 150 Colbert on the city's north side, and functionally obsolete in that it had two tiny bedrooms and a tiny bathroom, and most of our first-time home buyers are young families. So it's hard to get a young family to buy a house that they already outgrow by the time they move in. So what we did here is raise the roof, literally, put a dormer on, and this was a land bank property, and turned it from a tiny two-bedroom home into a four-bedroom home with two bathrooms, and a young family with children, and actually one on the way, purchased the property. They had been renting in the neighborhood, and it was just really a great fit for them. This year, we hope to do 62 of these types of renovations, and then with respect to demolition, we'll do about 50 demolitions and deconstructions, working with the land bank, with some city funding, some CIDA funding, and also some funding from neighborhood and business development. But to do this, you really need a system. And, you know, we played around with this slide a little bit yesterday, and we wanted to put this in a really nice package and put a bow on it as far as how we approach these rehabs. And you have to be organized, and I think we're pretty good at it, but I'd be lying to you if I told you that it's this perfect linear process of doing property evaluation, property rehab, marketing, and then preparing the home buyers. It's a very messy process, and frankly, it drives us nuts, and absolutely nuts. And we brought some of the staff today, Hillary and Callie and Andrew and Mary Jo and Laura and Shannon. They're involved in this every day. Should we purchase this property? Well, what do you need to know? Can we fix this property for the money that's available? And Hillary and Callie and Andrew will say, yes, we can fix it for the money that's available. But then Mary Jo will say, well, but I can't sell that property. For what we'd have to sell that property to get out of it, I've done comps in the neighborhood, and we can't sell it for that. So it is a somewhat linear process, but then you have to be prepared to go right back to the well. A great example of this is you might have identified a funding source to get the property renovated. After the specs are written and you get a contractors to bid on the job, you find you need more money. So we say, hey, Stephanie back there, we need a little bit more money. And she's very tight with the money. But even if we're able to get a few shekels out of her, she's got using federal money. So that means now you have to go back to the property, do a lead-based risk assessment, and it might be that although you got an extra $30,000 or $40,000 on the table, you've also increased your rehab costs by $25,000 or $30,000. So you tend to get involved in these loops. And ultimately, it gets done, but it's not with a lot of hard work and sometimes not total agreement. But somehow we managed to get through it. So we did have a little bit of fun with this as far as this linear process of how we determine which property should be renovated and what sources of funds we should use. But one thing that I really wanted to highlight, because I know Sandy wanted a lot of time for questions and answers, has to do with the financing. And as I said, we've really had to amend the way that we approach these. If you go back 5 or 6 years ago, anytime we renovated a property, there were banks tripping over each other to provide financing. And Chase had a program where they give low-mod buyers or people purchasing in low-mod census tracts a $3,500 grant. HSBC had a similar program. Frankly, those programs really don't exist anymore. So what we found is that as we renovate these homes, if the folks apply for private financing, it's going to take forever. And it might be that the bank turns these folks down. And these are young families who have been through homeowner training, might have a 670 credit score. That's not good enough to get a mortgage these days. For many, many years, it was good enough. And our experience is that these folks make great homeowners. But now they struggle. We had one case or a property that we renovated on the south side, And the prospective buyer went to her bank, a local bank. It took 11 months to get a decision. What do you do with the property? You've just renovated a property while you're waiting 11 months for the bank to decide whether they want to make a loan or not. So we respond to the voids in the market. We knew that we'd have to enter the first mortgage market, and we have started doing that. But you need lots of partners to do it. As an example, the 62 homes that we're going to renovate, we know that we're going to have to finance about 80% of those. That's $4.5 million of financing. Laura, we don't have $4.5 million laying around, do we? So what we got to do is originate those loans and then sell them to our lending partners who don't want to make the loans in the first place. And when they take those loans, they want loan guarantees. And the Reisman Foundation, the Gifford Foundation, the Allen Foundation have really helped us in providing those types of loan guarantees as credit enhancements. It's complicated, but that's the only way it will work. We've talked a lot about these homes for owner-occupants, but we've really worked with the Land Bank and Key Bank to try to come up with some financing for investors who are purchasing these properties. We can't sell all 1,800 or however many the Land Bank will eventually own. To owner-occupants, some will have to be sold to investors. Many will be sold to investors. And the mom-and-pop investors that are local, Caitlin talked about, you know, the investors from California and Brooklyn. And we haven't had great experience with those investors in this town. We'd rather sell those properties to local investors, mom-and-pop investors, as we call them. And we've put together a pilot program with $1.5 million made available by KeyBank. That will be for purchasers of land bank properties that are going to do the right thing, get them renovated, and turn them into affordable housing for folks. I think we're at this stage where resources are very scarce, and we need to be constantly trying a lot of these pilot programs, see what works, and then bring it to scale. Thanks.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you, Caitlin. You might have noticed that Carrie called me Sandy. That's a clue that I have known him a long, long, long time. I think I changed my name to Sandra when I was 30. So it's been quite a long time.
I was in grade school.
And he was just a tyke when we were both working at community development. So good to see you again. Fred.
Well, I was really delighted to hear that so many, you've touched so many of these vacant properties. It sounds like it may be almost a third of the that you have your hands on in some way, or approaching a third.
Well, I should say
maybe not quite. But here's my question: for just one point, was that we sold our mother's house by renting to a family, and then they accumulated enough rent to bring down the mortgage price, and that worked beautifully over 2 years. I wonder if you try that strategy. And the other question is, once the people are in the houses, it sounds like, you know, maybe they'd live happily ever after, but do you have to provide continued support to some of them, or is there a little backsliding?
Sure, I think I can take that. First off, the rent to own is a great option, and even beyond that, we use funding from the Federal Home Loan Bank. It's something called the First Home Club. And basically, for a family who might have to work on their credit for a year or two before they are in a position to purchase a home, if they go on a savings program, the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York will actually match 4-to-1 the dollars that they put aside while they're fixing up their credit issues. And we use that tool all the time. And that's really a great tool to get that first-time home buyer, particularly a young family, into a house, because probably the mortgage payment's going to be less than they're paying for rent, but they can't amass the funds for down payment and closing costs, and that really takes care of that issue. With respect to the ongoing support, that's really where our counseling efforts come in, because we always say a customer of Home Headquarters, it's cradle to grave. You may help them purchase a home, and then 2 or 3 years later, something goes wrong with the property. You've got to be there with affordable home ownership programs to support them. And then it's not unusual for these first-time home buyers to get in a little trouble the first time they get that killer bill from National Grid in the winter. Their budget gets sent into a tailspin, and they'll make an appointment with one of our counselors. We'll review the budget and come up with some options. So you have to be willing to provide that support over a long period of time.
Good morning. I know the north side the best, and one of the things that seems to have happened is zoning has been totally ignored, and extensions have been put on homes for small businesses. So if the land bank takes over such a building, do they strip it back to its original intent, or do they grandfather in any existing business opportunities?
Well, we certainly can't supersede any existing zoning regulations. So if we get a property that's already in violation of a zoning law, then we're going to have to address that. There have been a number of instances where we've gotten a property that is an illegal non-conforming use, and oftentimes that may be the factor in what helps us decide whether or not to demolish the property. If it really can't be marketed as a commercial property, and yet it looks like a store, you know, walks like a duck, talks like a duck, we can't market it as a commercial property. I'm excited, though, to say that the city is going to be significantly revamping its zoning code, and maybe the mayor will be talking about that when she's here. She mentioned it in her State of the City address, and we're hopeful that the zoning regs are going to much more closely conform to the city's long-range plan in the future.
This question for Carrie. Do you have an idea of the demographics of the people that are buying the homes?
Yes, they're generally young families, probably three children. They have the programs that are used to renovate the homes usually have some kind of an income restriction. But depending on the funding source, those income restrictions can change. So that's another thing that sort of drives us crazy about this process. But in some of the programs, you can go up to 120% of the area median. Other programs, you can go up to 112%. And many you have to stay under 80% of the area median. So, you know, we're looking at families of say four or five with incomes in the 40s. We can turn that family into an owner occupant. These are very affordable. Again, where they probably pay a little bit less in their mortgage, even when you include in the taxes and insurance, than they were paying in rent.
Good morning. The housing stock was originally built to accommodate 250 or so thousand people in Syracuse. There are 100,000 fewer now. Does that mean that there will always be vacant houses in our community?
Well, in any healthy real estate market, you have what's called frictional vacancy. There's properties that are for lease, properties that are for sale, and we figure about 5% is normal. What's more alarming is we see some neighborhoods in the city where the vacancy rate is 20% right now. And I think that just because something's vacant, going ahead and demolishing all those vacants until you get down to 5% isn't necessarily the solution. I think there's got to be some churn. What we're really hoping for is that by getting these properties renovated, we're going to get higher quality rental units on the market. And then, you know, there's a lot of dilapidated buildings that are occupied right now that maybe shouldn't be occupied due to their condition. So we're hoping that over the course of the next decade, I don't know, we'll be doing this until I retire, that churn will result in better quality units being renovated and staying occupied and the worst quality units being deconstructed.
I just wanted to follow up on that. And although I don't know what the ratio is, but I'm guessing the ratio of population to household has changed so that there are more smaller households. And I was thinking about that, you know, one in two families, either people without kids or young people living on their own, mm-hmm. and that there are many of them who don't want to own a house. My daughter said yesterday she's taking care of a neighbor's house while the neighbor is gone, and the roof is leaking. Guess what? You know, the icicles were melting, and she said, I'm never going to own a house. So maybe, maybe not. But, I mean, so in terms of your mom and pop, is that... that there is a demand for more rental housing in the city as well. There aren't just people who want to own, but there are more people who would like to live in the city in decent rental properties. So are you kind of gearing your renovations toward maybe some non-family units?
So far, the renovations that have been funded through grants that we're partnering with Home Headquarters on are all resulting in owner-occupied units. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to say, and I forgot to mention earlier, of those 105 properties that we've sold so far, the vast majority of them are structures. And historically, when the city was selling seizable properties, it was mostly vacant lots that were getting sold to next-door neighbors. And I think because people can and must inspect these properties prior to purchasing them, that we're making the structures more attractive to these local mom-and-pop landlords now. And most of those are being done without grant subsidies at this point, but we're hopeful that we'll be able to make more of them a possibility through this loan program so that more local landlords can purchase these properties and get quality rentals on the market. But there's no doubt that we need more quality, affordable rentals in Syracuse. A third of the households living in the city are below the poverty line, and those are probably not going to be buying houses from Home Headquarters.
My name is Jay Suvedi, and I work for the refugee population. I'm a case manager, and I came as a refugee in 2008, and I owned the home in 2011, and I paid off my mortgage in 2014. So it seems that we have a community which is a really, really hardworking community, and in last 5 years, I see like more than 80 homeowners on the north side from my own community. And there are hundreds of other new refugees and immigrants who comes to the north side, and after a couple of years, they want to own the home. And now my point is there any focus program from Land Bank and from Home Headquarters that is specifically focus on those new population that we can give them a new home and raise the new family?
Well, I think there's just so many incentives that we have that would really apply to the types of families that you're speaking about, but or to anyone. And, you know, we work very closely with all of our neighborhood-based not-for-profits, North Side Up, NIDA on the North Side as an example. And by and large, they're sort of feeding us those families that would be great candidates. So it's not that difficult. You go through some home buyer training just so that we make sure that the family is going to be successful. And lots of incentives. We have down payment and closing cost assistance. Again, we talked about the first home club. And it doesn't have to be that they would purchase a home from Home Headquarters. You could just purchase a house on the private market and still avail yourselves to the financing that we have, to down payment and closing cost assistance. So really the sky's the limit. And I think we understand that in order to increase the homeownership rate, there's a lot of discussion nationally about has a homeownership been overbuilt. Well, that's easy to say in the balance of the country when homeownership rates are about 66%. But in the city of Syracuse, at 39%, we've got a long ways to go. There are the incentives that are there, and these can be really successful.
Thank you.
You
had a question?
So part of this is really stabilizing neighborhoods. And the home ownership program and your rental assistance programs make it possible for people to move into neighborhoods. And along with that really is a question of how does that work? What's the track record? Have the loans that you've been able to make, have they been paid? And, is the track record good in terms of the length of time that families stay in the neighborhoods that they move into?
Yeah. Our track record is excellent. With our home.
I sort of thought that.
So thank you for that, Min. But the just go back to a little bit of ancient history here. When we were first coming up with these revolving loan funds, as an example, to support existing homeowners, we have our board has 21 members. There's about 7 bankers on there. They tend to be very conservative, and they just didn't think that these folks who couldn't qualify for any other type of financing would pay us back. Just the banks didn't want to lend to them. The credit unions didn't want to lend to them. And Shannon, what's our delinquency rate right now? Right, about 5 or 6%. And this is a population that nobody else in the community would lend to. So it's been great. On the first mortgage side, when we sell those loans to the banks, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the reason we need loan guarantees is because the bank says, well, wait a minute, if I'm putting this on my books, if it goes bad, you have to take it back because I'm not taking the hit from my regulator on this. So we have a money-back guarantee when we sell a loan to a lending institution, and that's why we need the credit enhancements from the foundations to help us with that. But I don't think we have one delinquent first mortgage right now in inventory. But again, these things don't happen quickly. We work with these families over a period of years, really, to build their credit, purchase a home, save their down payment money. The last thing they want to do after going through all of that is lose this home. And by the way, we're doing a survey, and because we were recently involved in a national competition that had to do with the Next Awards from Wells Fargo, and we were a finalist, but we didn't win it. And one of the reasons was it seemed that nationally, folks just had a concern about the investment potential for these families. Like, well, you're buying a home in Syracuse, which is a slow market, a weak market, and is it really a good thing to have these folks purchase a home that may not appreciate in value that much? And the Maxwell's going to do the analysis for us, but the initial response that we've seen is that's not why these families are buying homes. They're not buying homes at $60,000, hoping to sell them in 3 years for $90,000. They just want a stable place for their family to grow up.
Yes, certainly in a community like Syracuse, you can't view your home as a retirement investment, but like Carrie said, oftentimes you're in a higher quality place now paying less than you were for rent. Why wouldn't you make that decision?
Thanks.
Would you comment a little more about the down payment business, how that's financed with these people?
Well, for families that don't have a lot of money saved, there is this wonderful program through the Federal Home Loan Bank where for every dollar that they save over a period of 10 months to 2 years, the Federal Home Loan Bank will match it $4 for that $1. And you can amass $7,500 between 10 months and 2 years to use for your down payment and your closing costs. And that's really important because, again, most of these families, they can certainly afford the mortgage payment and the taxes and insurance. But what they have trouble coming up with is the down payment. It's a great tool.
And they enroll in that program through your homeownership center?
They do. They have to go through home buyer training to do that. But there's many banks and credit unions right now that are offering that first home club option.
Okay. When you're redesigning a house, either when you're building a new infill or redesigning, are you doing it with a particular buyer in mind, or you're doing that and then putting it on the market? I'm thinking about when the Near West Side project got started and there were some talk about either homes that some people felt didn't fit in the neighborhood, or else that the people who were living in the neighborhood, those wouldn't be the kinds of houses they would want. So kind of, and you know, energy efficiency and all of that were part of the mix. So can you speak to how you decide to your designs?
Sure. And pretty much the way this works these days is it's really, somebody would have to have an awful lot of imagination to want to buy this house, right? So what usually winds up happening is we start renovating it, and it's really not until you've gutted out the interior and now you've got the sheetrock up and it's starting to take shape and you have a new roof on the property that folks get interested. There's a buzz on the street. Oh, gee, maybe my sister or brother or nephew would want to purchase that home. And when we obviously have colors picked out and countertops picked out, but if we identify the buyer soon enough in the process, they can have an awful lot of say in flooring selection, countertop selection, color selection, that sort of thing. But it really is all over the place. But we've had a really good track record recently with as soon as the property is renovated, we have a buyer. Because the last thing you want to do is leave that property vacant after it's been renovated for any length of time. You really want it to be occupied right away.
Does the issue of are you purchasing and renovating homes in the floodplain, and then just in general, is the issue of home insurance, does that is that an issue for the home buyers just because there are sometimes other vacant houses in the neighborhood, or the pricing of it.
Yeah. We've not had a terrible problem with helping people get homeowners insurance. If they get rejected by one company or the price seems really high, our counselors will help them find a company that's a little bit more reasonable. The flood insurance issue, though, is significant. We have had major redevelopment projects in the Skunk City neighborhood, and most of the neighborhood is in a floodplain. And I think as a community, we have to figure that out. As we're renovating homes there now and then folks get private mortgages, not only are the banks these days requiring flood insurance for the value of the home, but now they're requiring replacement. So you might have a house that is worth $50,000, but if it was to get flooded out and rebuilt, it would cost $150,000. Well, they're requesting $150,000 worth of flood coverage, and that is extremely expensive. That might be $1,500 a year, as an example. How is a young family supposed to afford that on top of their homeowner's insurance? So I think as a community, we need to figure out whether we should be making investments in those neighborhoods that are in the flood zone.
Well, thank you, Caitlin Wright and Carrie Quaglia, for talking about the land bank and home headquarters.